that case, I said, that leaves us with the task of describing the most delightful of regimes and the most delightful of individuals, tyranny and the tyrant. It certainly does, he said. Does tyranny arise out of democracy much the same way as democracy arises out of oligarchy? How do you mean? The thing they held up as an ideal, I said, the thing which formed the basis of oligarchy, was wealth, wasn't it? Yes. It was the insatiable longing for wealth and the neglect of everything else in the pursuit of profit which destroyed oligarchy. True, he said. And is it the insatiable longing for what it defines as good which destroys democracy too in its turn? What is it, you say, it defines as good? Freedom, I said. This is the thing, I imagine, which in a democratic state you will hear described as its finest attribute, and what makes it, for any free spirit, the only place worth living in. Yes, that is certainly something you often hear said. Well then, as I was saying just now, is it the insatiable longing for this good, and the neglect of everything else, which brings about a change in this regime too, and creates the need for tyranny? How does that happen? He asked. I imagine it's when a democracy, in its thirst for the wine of freedom, finds the wine being poured by unscrupulous cupbearers, and when it drinks more deeply than it should of pure, unmixed freedom. Then, if its magistrates are not totally easygoing and do not offer it that freedom in large quantities, it accuses them of being filthy oligarchs and punishes them. Yes, he said, that is what they do. Those who obey the rulers are heaped with insults. They are regarded as servile non-entities. Praise and respect, whether in private or public life, go to rulers for behaving like those they rule, and to those they rule for behaving like rulers. Isn't the desire for freedom in a city of this type bound to run to extremes? Of course it is. And isn't the anarchy bound to make its way, my friend, into private households? Can we give an example of that? A father, for example, gets used to being like a child and being afraid of his sons. A son gets used to being like his father. He feels no respect or fear for his parents. All he wants is to be free. Immigrants are put on a par with citizens, and citizens with immigrants, and the same with visiting foreigners. Yes, that's what happens. That, plus a few more trivial examples of the same kind, I said, in a society of this sort, teachers are afraid of their pupils and curry favour with them. Pupils have an equal contempt for their teachers and their attendants. In general, the young are the image of their elders and challenge them in everything they say and do. The old descend to the level of the young. They pepper everything with wit and humour, trying to be like the young, because they don't want to be thought harsh or dictatorial. Precisely, he said. But the extreme limit of freedom in a city of this kind comes when those who have been bought as slaves, whether male or female, are every bit as free as those who bought them. As for the relationship of women to men and men to women, I all but forgot to mention the extent of the legal equality and liberty between them. To generalise from all these collected observations, have you noticed how sensitive it makes the souls of the citizens, so that if anyone seeks to impose the slightest degree of slavery, they grow angry and cannot tolerate it? In the end, as I imagine you are aware, they take no notice even of the laws, written or unwritten, in their determination that no one shall be master over them in any way at all. Yes, I'm well aware of that, he said. This is the form of government, my friend, so attractive and so headstrong, from which I believe tyranny is born. Certainly headstrong, he said, but what is the next step? We mentioned the class of idle and extravagant men, the most courageous element leading, the least courageous element following. We compared them to drones, the leaders to drones with stings, the followers to drones without stings. Rightly so. Very well. Let's make a theoretical division of the democratic city into three parts. After all, this is how it is, in fact, composed. This class of drones, I imagine, is one part. And because of the absence of restrictions, it grows at least as freely in a democracy as in an oligarchy. That is so. But it is much fiercer in a democracy than in an oligarchy. In what way? In an oligarchy, it is treated as of no value and excluded from power. So it gets no exercise and does not develop its strength. In a democracy, by contrast, barring a few individuals, it is the dominant influence in the state. The fiercest element in this class does the talking and acting. The remainder sit around the rostrum, buzzing and refusing to allow the expression of any other view. The result is that in a regime of this kind, everything, with very few exceptions, is run by the class of drones. Exactly, he said. Then there's a second class, which always separates itself off from the majority. What class is that? When everyone is engaged in making money, presumably it is those with the most disciplined temperament who generally become the richest. Very likely. They provide a plentiful supply of honey for the drones, I imagine, and an easy source from which to extract it. Yes, he said, after all, they can't extract much from those who haven't got much. They're called the rich, these people we're talking about, the drones' feeding ground. That's about it, he said. The general populace would be the third class, manual labourers with little interest in politics and very little property of their own. This is the most numerous and powerful class in a democracy, but only when it is assembled together. It is indeed, he said, but if it isn't getting some share of the honey, it is reluctant to assemble very often. That's why it always does get a share of it, if its leaders have anything to do with it. They take it away from those who possess property and distribute it among the people, keeping only the lion's share for themselves. Yes, the people do get a limited share of that sort, he said. Those whose property is taken away are presumably compelled to defend themselves by speaking in the assembly and taking whatever other action they can. Of course, even if they have no desire at all for revolution, they are accused by the others of plotting against the people and being oligarchs. Naturally. In the end, when they see the people attempting to injure them, not maliciously, but out of ignorance, misled by their opponents, at that point, whether they like it or not, the rich really do become oligarchs, though not from choice. This, too, is an evil implanted in them by the stings of the drone we were talking about. It is indeed. Then you get impeachments, litigation, and lawsuits between the two classes. You certainly do. And isn't there a universal tendency for the people to set up one single individual who is their own particular champion? Don't they feed him up and make him mighty? They do. So, when we look at the growth of a tyrant, I said, one thing at least is clear. This position of champion is the sole root from which the tyrant springs. Yes, that's absolutely clear.